So tonight is the first of this 6 week course I'm teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and I'm going to start at the beginning, which is of course the First Noble Truth. But even before that, I think it's useful to look at, in a sense, the origin story of the Buddha. Like what made him go out and practice as he did and come to the understanding of the Four Noble Truths? What was it that motivated him? And there's this famous story, which may be mythical, apocryphal, but it's the story that's always told. I mean, he was a prince. I mean, he was living in a palace. He had a wife and a child, and he lived in total luxury. And his father protected him quite fiercely from anything that would be unpleasant. He was just going to only have a pleasant, wonderful life. And eventually, he rebelled a little bit and said, "You know, I can't just live in this palace. I got to get out and see the world." You know, he was 29, so his rebellion came a little late, but you know, better late than never, right? So his father said, "Okay, you can go outside the palace, but you have to go with the guard, some guards, and you go on horseback. So you can't just sort of walk around, you know, gotta look like a prince." So off they go, and they're riding along, and the Buddha sees this person, but it's all bent over, and he's kind of wrinkled and walking really slowly, and the Buddha asks the guard, says, "What's that?" And the guard says, "Well, that's an old person. You know, as you get old, that's what happens to your body." Buddha's like, "Oh my God!" And he's gonna ha that that's gonna happen. That happens to everybody. He says, "Oh yeah, that happens to everybody." Okay. So then another ride, another day, out they are riding again, and he sees this man sort of lying beside the road, and he's all covered in sores, and the sores are kind of oozy and smelly. And the Buddha said to the guard, "What's that?" He says, "Oh, that's someone who's sick, because he's got this terrible disease." Buddha says, "Does that happen to everybody?" He says, the guard says, "Yeah, pretty much everybody gets sick eventually. It's just part of life, you know." Next time out, they go out again. They see these people walking along, and they're carrying someone on a big pallet on their shoulders, and everybody's crying and wailing, and there's this thing lying on the pallet. And the Buddha says, "Well, what's that?" And the guy says, "Well, that's a dead body. You know, they're taking him to the ghat to be burned." Like, "Wow, and that happens to everybody too, you know." And the Buddha, so at this point, the Buddha's like just going, "Oh my God, how can I possibly be happy knowing that just like everyone else, I'm gonna get old, I'm gonna get sick, I'm gonna die?" It's just like he's really disturbed and upset. Fourth ride out, and they come across this man. He's just has a simple robe. He's got a bowl. He's got a walking stick, but he looks really happy. It's really happy. He's smiling, and he's just sort of being generous with everybody around him. And the Buddha says to the guard, "Well, what's that? Who's that guy?" And the guy says, "Oh, that's a sadhu, a monk." And yeah, the Buddha says, "So how does he? Why does he look so happy?" And the guard doesn't know. It's just the guard. So the Buddha stops and talks, and the sadhu explains, you know, "You can be happy if you practice in this way." And the Buddha's like, "Oh my God, this guy has a solution to this problem that's really been vexing me." And he runs away from home. Right? This is the classic story. He runs away from home. I mean, he has a magic horse that leaps over the walls if you want to go that far, but it's like he runs away. His family goes in to a couple of teachers who teach him concentration, but he finds that, well, being concentrated is great. When he's in deep states of concentration, he's really happy. But then he has to lead the rest of his life, and when he's not in these deep states of concentration, and he's still faced with the essential dilemma that he was trying to solve. how can I be happy when I know? Then he tries, goes the opposite direction and lives a very austere life in the forest for 5 years. That doesn't work. He's just basically, he's decided if he really suffers as much as he possibly can, he'll understand suffering and then he'll be able to figure it out. And so then he leaves that. Eventually does his own thing, finds the middle way, becomes enlightened, and then he goes to teach. He almost didn't go teach, but a deva came and convinced them that there were people out there with little dust in their eyes who could see the truth if he helped them wash that dust out of their eyes. I love that image. So the first time he taught the Four Noble Truths. So this is how we got to the Four Noble Truths. I thought it was important we laid that out. The First Noble Truth in Pali is Sarvam Dukkham. Traditionally, it's translated as something like the truth of suffering, or all is suffering, or the world is full of suffering. When I first encountered Buddhism in my 20s, that's what I heard. It was like this sort of grim message. And I was like, a young hippie, right? Looking for something. And I was like, oh, these Buddhists, what a bunch of downers these people are. And I went to a couple of meetings, and this is all I talked about was suffering and suffering and ugh. And I never went back. It took me another 30 years to figure out that what they were really starting to talk about. And the truth is that all those translations are really incomplete and kind of off-putting. And so what is it, how can we translate it? So the word dukkha is the Pali breakdown. The ka, second part of the word, it means wheel. And a dukkha is a, so these are, I don't know if you, in South Asia, they have these huge ox carts, which are two-wheeled, and the wheels themselves are solid wood, and they're enormous. They're like, they're, 6 feet tall, big round wheels they construct. And the dukkha is a wheel with the center hole where the axle fits off center. So that as you're sitting on the cart and you're riding along, the wheel turns and the cart sort of goes, you get jerked over and over. Every time, all day, you're sitting in the cart and everywhere you go, you're getting jerked. So it's like, it's a terrible bumpy ride. And it's basically, another way to think of dukkha is, life is constantly jerking me around. That might be a colloquial translation, okay? But I think it's kind of a good one. And another way to put that more traditional teaching translation is that life is unsatisfactory. It's unreliable. It doesn't work in the sense that when we live it in the conventional sense, not paying attention to things we should be paying attention to, it doesn't make us happy. We're happy some of the time, and I'm not denying for the fact, you can't deny, it's because daily experience can be totally wonderful. I went out this morning, I went out to have breakfast with a friend, and we sat in Dot's Diner and had a nice breakfast, and then I went and got some paint at the paint store, and I was having a great day, right? It was a wonderful day. But it's like, and it doesn't solve the problem the Buddha came to, which was, but everyone's going to get sick, everyone's going to get old, everyone's going to die, and I have to, how do I live with that and still be happy at the same time? And the second layer of this is that the reason thing that the life is as it is unreliable, is unsatisfactory, is that when the Buddha started to really look, he said, everything is impermanent. Nothing stays the same. Everything is changing all the time. And so that means that nothing's reliable, because if it's, by reliable we mean something that's permanent, that's solid, it's always going to be there. It'll always make me happy. Nothing is reliable. Nothing is going to stay there all the time. That's what the conclusion that the Buddha came to. And this is true even of things we think make us really happy, things we just like. My old teacher, Swami Vishnudevananda, used to have this story he'd tell. And it was about what he called it, the Liz and Dick story. So this is like Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. So, if you want to sort of modernize this into, Sean Penn and Madonna or something, or, some other, I'm not hip to who's hip these days, so I don't know, but that was the latest hip couple, whatever it is, right? But his thing was Liz and Dick. And so anyhow, Liz and Dick are walking down some street, and they walk past the jewelry store, and they look in the window, and there's this beautiful, incredible pair of diamond earrings. And Liz just goes, "Oh God, they're so beautiful." Next day, they're sitting at dinner, and Dick pulls out a little box and hands it to her, and she opens it up, and it's like, it's the diamond earrings. She was something she really wanted, and there they were. And she was just like, "Oh, Dick, you're so wonderful." And then she puts them on, and she's looking at them, and she goes and looks in the mirror, and everybody's going, "Oh, those are so beautiful." And she's just totally happy. Totally. She thinks this is it. She's totally happy. But then she starts to think later on in the evening, "Oh, these are really valuable. What if someone steals them? Maybe we got to get fake versions of these I can wear in normal situations and only wear the real ones in special occasions, right? So now I have to sort of take care of this stuff I got." But she still looks at them when she takes them off at night, and they're still really beautiful, and she's still like, "That Dick, he's so wonderful." Next day, one of her friends tells her that Dick has been messing around. And it's like, she looks at the earrings and she goes, "Ugh, that Dick gave me those earrings. I hate these earrings. They're ugly. They're horrible. And Dick gave them to me. Blah, 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 blah." Same object, but totally unreliable as a source of happiness. Because things changed. The situation changed. It wasn't like Dick is wonderful, isn't it wonderful? He gave me these things. If Dick is a jerk, he's messing around. I hate those earrings. Same object, totally different reaction, totally different affect. This is what happens all the time with everything, no matter what. You cannot think of anything in your life that isn't like this, including relationships with all the people you love really dearly. Because they all change. I mean, if nothing else, everyone around you, everyone you're dear, who's dear to you, everyone who's close to you, they're all going to die. And if you are still around when they die, you're going to suffer. Guaranteed. Grief will arise. It's just built in to any relationship you have with another human being that makes you happy. It's eventually it won't. Or you'll die and they'll be unhappy, but it's going to cause unhappiness no matter what. And I'm not saying, oh, I mean, one solution to that is to become a monk and not have any relationships with anybody, but that's not a very practical solution, at least not for me, and for most people. We have relationships, and so it's like now we have to sort of go, oh, yeah, that's true too. And this is just the nature of everything. This is the truth of living in the world and being a human being and having a body and relating to others. This is, and the thing is, if we're not careful, we live a lot of our life pretending that that's true for other people, but not for me. Well, everybody else is going to die, but not me. Everybody else is going to get sick, but not me. That's how, if we're not careful, we get caught in that way of thinking. It's like, I'm not affected by this stuff, just everybody else is, because we don't want to think about it. So that's one way to one way to think about this. Here's another way. And it's interesting when you think about the Four Noble Truths that it's like it was the first thing the Buddha taught. But it's also one of the last things he tells us we have to understand. This is in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, the very last instruction. Reads as follows. Here one knows as it really is, this is dukkha. One knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. One knows as it really is, this is the cessation of dukkha. One should knows as it really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. It's the Four Noble Truths. The very last thing we have to understand as we go deeper and deeper into this practice is we really have to know as it really is. It's not like some theoretical idea. Yeah, I heard Barry talk about this, and yeah, it all makes sense to me. Or Barry had the same experience, heard someone else talk about it, or read it in a book, whatever. We can sort of intellectually take it in, but what he's saying here is no, we have to experience it in our heart mind. We have to know as it really is. So this is both like the Four Noble Truths is like the very beginning teachings, but it's also the last thing. This is like the whole of the Buddha's teachings are contained in this container of the Four Noble Truths. It's and I find that interesting. That's why I wanted to mention it. But what does it mean to know it as it really is? This is dukkha. And basically, there are three forms that dukkha takes. And first of these is just the dukkha of painful experience, whether it's a physical experience, like, someone, you hurt yourself physically, you fall down and break a bone, or you have a relationship and the person runs away with somebody else, or you have a great job and then the job disappears, or whatever. We all have painful experiences in our life. It's just because everything's changing all the time. This is like absolutely true. So this is both physical and mental pain. Painful experiences are going to arise in our lives. This is unpleasant. And basically, this is inevitable for everyone. And we create our own suffering. We cause our own suffering by fighting against this idea. Like, no, that's not going to happen to me. I'm only ever going to have good stuff. I only want the good stuff. I don't want any of the other stuff. And because we cling to things and think they're going to last forever, then they don't. Then our suffering arises, and we've now created our own suffering. This is called, in classical Buddhism, the second Dart effect. And I want to actually read the sutta that talks about this. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, and this is in the Samyutta Nikaya on the section called the whole section in the Samyutta Nikaya on the called the Book of the Six Sense Bases. Bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling, that's us, feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. The instructed noble disciple too feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. There in bhikkhus, what is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling? So what's the difference between someone who's enlightened or who's deeply practiced in the path and us regular folks? And the monks, of course, say, yes, tell us all about that. It says, bhikkhus, when the uninstructed worldly being is contacted by a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So suppose they were to strike a man with a dart, and then they would strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart, so that the man would feel feelings caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldlings is being contacted by a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So not only does he have the unpleasant experience of what happened, but then we caught up in the emotional mental turmoil based on what happened. It's not fair, it shouldn't be this way, how come it's happening to me? All those things that we go through. And then Buddha goes on, he says, being contacted by that same painful feeling, he harbors aversion towards it. When he harbors aversion towards painful feeling, the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feelings lies behind this. Being contacted by a painful feeling, he seeks delight in sensual pleasure. For what reason? Because the uninstructed worldly does not know of any escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasure. The only way we know how to make ourselves feel good is find something. I'm going to go find something pleasant. And so, once again, he's pointing very directly to this second dart. By how we react when these things arise, that's what creates our own suffering. By just basically, we got hit with a dart, and instead of doing someone who's wise, which is to be unattached to the experience itself, like not, and I'm not saying these things aren't unpleasant. It's no fun getting sick. It's no fun getting old. It happens. It's not that, but we, it's like, it's what we have to understand is that there's nothing we can do about these things. It's going to happen. And getting all caught up in lamenting and grieving just makes it worse. It's like we got hit with one dart, then we say, oh, let's stab another dart in too and make sure it's really miserable, make ourselves really miserable. Right? That's what we do over and over and over again by not just seeing that this is normal. This is the natural order of the world. So that's the second dart. And basically, you're suffering because you're in contention with reality. You think, no, this is not the way it should be. It shouldn't be this way. It's not fair. Whatever language you think of or use. But you're just in contention with reality. Because reality says, yes, this is going to happen. You are going to have really unpleasant experiences. It's part of being, having a human body and a human mind. Just that's the way it is. So it's like how we react to them is what we have to look at. Because we can't change reality. We have to accept reality for what it is. So the second of these is this is that's the first cause of dukkha. And we have to know it as it really is, we have to know that this is true. That these things are inevitable. We can't do anything to change that. The second is the dukkha brought about by change. We lose what we want to keep, and we have to bear what we don't like. Everything's changing. Everything goes through a cycle of arising, being present, and disappearing. And we can never succeed in pushing away what we don't, or wanting, or holding on to things we want to keep. It never works. But we think somehow that it should. We think somehow that certain things shouldn't change or aren't ever going to change. But they all are. Without exception, without exception, they're going to change. This is Joseph Goldstein again. So, and Joseph, what Joseph's talking about is how we can work skillfully with the fact that we know, if we really let it in, that everything is going to change no matter what. And there's this great teaching called the Five Remembrances that I keep coming back to because it seems so powerful. And basically, this is the Buddha talking again. Bhikkhus, there are five themes that should often be reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder or by one gone forth. So everyone, in other words. One, what's fat five? One, I'm subject to old age. I'm not exempt from old age. Two, I'm subject to illness. I'm not exempt from illness. Three, I'm subject to death. I'm not exempt from death. Four, I must be parted from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. And five, I'm the owner of my karma, the heir of my karma. I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my last resort. I will be heir to whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. So, how I act creates either happiness or suffering. And these are called the five remembrances. I know people, I have had periods of my life when I've done this, I haven't been doing it lately, where they actually have these five remembrances written down. And as they go and sit, every day, they read the five remembrances first. To take this in. We keep, they call them remembrances. Remind yourself over and over and over again that this is the truth. You know, this is knowing dukkha as it really is. This is the truth. We can't avoid them. We can't pretend they're not true. So constantly remind yourself. It's one way to help you remember, because we keep forgetting. And we get caught up in things and how things are, and oh my God, this painting's turning out so well, and then blah, who knows what's going to happen to that painting, but I think it's going to be wonderful, and I can see it in a gallery any day now, and blah, 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 blah. You know, we just get caught up in stuff. And without saying, well, who knows whether I'll be around tomorrow for that painting, or you know, whether the gallery I think is going to burn down. Think about what people is going on right now. Thousands of houses and galleries and businesses are just being destroyed, just like that, out in LA. Nobody knew that was going to happen. But that's because the world is unreliable. And people thought those things are all permanent. All gone. Just like that. It's incredible. So the five remembrances are just something we want to pay attention to, because they remind us that everything is changing all the time. Without exception, everything is going to change. It's just the way it is. So that's the second layer of dukkha, or the second way that we have to know dukkha. And then I like the third one I like. It's called the dukkha of everyday life. Everything we do, everything we have to do, just to sort of, you know, quote, keep it together, you know, make sure we have food in the house so we can make dinner, you know, make sure the house is clean, get to my job on time, blah, blah, you know, that endless list of stuff that we have to deal with in the material world just because we're alive and everybody has to deal with this stuff. And we keep, the problem is that we keep fooling ourselves that everything's okay. Everything's fine. It's just, life is great. Often through a total lack of attention to all the stuff that isn't so good. We get caught up in this space of looking at all the good stuff and ignoring the fact that all this other stuff is there too, but we don't want to think about it. And that's sort of a natural human tendency. It's like being like this, what human beings do. But it causes us to suffer over and over again. We think, no, it'll be better this time. How many times have we said that, huh? I think back to my college days, which is a long time ago, 50 odd years ago, and how I was at one point, early on in my college days at least, how I'm sure, I think it's called binge drinking. Where you just drink and drink and drink until you were so drunk. And I remember the first time that this happened, and I was like, I woke up lying in a bathroom stall on the floor. I passed out. And it was like, oh my God, how could I let myself? And I was dirty and smelly, and it was like horrible. But then I'd do it again. Because it'd be like getting to that point where I ended up passed out on the bathroom stall floor was this great party where I was having a really good time. And I kept thinking, oh, this time that won't happen to me. Until I finally figured out, duh, every time I do this, this is what happens. Yeah. And then I stopped doing it. My last year of college, I was in with partying with a bunch of guys in a bar, and I said, oh, this is what's going to happen again. And I literally, sitting in the bar with these guys, I stood up and walked out of the bar. And never did that to myself again. It was like the first time I really woke up, I think, said, wait a second, this doesn't work. It took me a while. I mean, this is my last year of college, and I started it the first year of college, but this is sort of what college was all about back in those days. I mean, these days everybody's getting high on stuff instead, but I mean, back then, this was like how you celebrated, sort of. Anyhow, so it's like, and this is how we end up causing our own suffering because we don't see. We keep thinking it's going to be okay this time. It's going to work this time. It'll be better this time. And it's just never actually true. But we it takes us, some of us, a very long time to figure this out. And then on top of all of that, on top of these three things that we have to understand, we make ourselves suffer even more. If anything, there's a third dart by blaming ourselves. Oh, what's wrong with me? How can I be so stupid? Blah, 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 blah. And it's good to blame yourself a little bit if you're learning from your mistakes. I'm not saying you can't learn from your mistakes. But when you keep going through that cycle over and over again and then blaming yourself over and over and over again, oh, there you are, just causing yourself more suffering. And part of that is, if we're not careful, especially when it comes to the first layer, of like the fact that yes, we're going to get old, yes, we're going to get sick, yes, we're going to die. This is inevitable. Is that we buy into the idea that being a good hippie, everything happens for a reason. How many times have you heard that one said, right? Everything happens for a reason. So if something bad or unpleasant happens, it must be our fault. Must be my fault that I have cancer. I must have done something in this life or another life that I'm being punished for it this way. I'm a hospital chaplain. I come across this one way too many times. Like, it's not your fault. Stuff just happens. It's, and this is a misunderstanding of karma. You know, the teachings on karma, that we think that we have no control, no hope, everything is predestined. This is a misinterpretation of karma that's really prevalent in our quote spiritual culture. And I want to read something else from the Samyutta Nikaya. It's from the same section, but this is someone has come to speak with the Buddha. Master Gotama, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this: whatever a person experiences, whether it is pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, all that is caused by what has been done in the past. What does the Master Gotama say about this? So this is the common view, and this is taught in certain in several traditions today, that everything is predestined because what I did in the past, now I have to experience it in the present moment, in some way or another, or in this life. It's totally controlled, nothing I can do about it. And here's the Buddha's response. Some feelings arising here originating from bile disorders. That some feelings arise here originating from bile disorders, one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this: whatever a person experiences, whether it is pleasant or painful or pleasant or painful, all that is caused by what has was done in the past. They overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. So it's like, yeah, it might be karma, but it might be you have a bile disorder. And then he lists, then this is great. He says, then he says, some people arise from phlegm disorders, from wind disorders, originating from an imbalance of the three, produced by a change of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault. All these things might be what the causes and conditions that created that unpleasant thing experience to arise. And notice that most of these we have no control over at all. Stuff just happens. And it's not like it's our fault. It's not like we shouldn't blame ourselves when something unpleasant happens because it, oh well, you know, I deserve this. I deserve this. I hear that one a lot too. And having said all of this, yes, all these things are the truth of dukkha. The truth, you know, this is the understanding dukkha as it truly is. It doesn't mean we should be passive when things become unpleasant. It's like, oh well, it's the way things are. You know, it's easy to fall into that one too. It's like, it simply means that we should see things as they really are from a space of clarity and be able to react appropriately without coming from a harder mind clouded by suffering. Yes, this unpleasant thing has happened or is happening. How can I skillfully, without getting caught in the moaning and groaning and it's not fair and this is inevitable, all these things that we get caught in, how can I react skillfully to this and work with it so that I see it for what it is and I can be okay and still be happy? That's what the truth of the First Noble Truth is really getting to. Yes, all this stuff is inevitable. Yes, all this stuff is going to happen. Yes, we keep believing it's not and causing our own suffering. Instead, can we see it arising and go, oh, this now. Okay. Let's now deal with this as skillfully as I can. And it's going to be unpleasant. It may be unpleasant for a long time. Maybe unpleasant for the rest of my life. But that's okay. to learn to be able to say, and that's okay. I don't have to suffer because of this. The suffering, the second dart layer of suffering, is optional. That's also seeing dukkha as it really is, that it's totally optional. Most of our suffering is we create ourselves, and it's totally optional. We just have to learn to skillfully react to what's arising instead of being overwhelmed by it. That's what this practice is all about, in a way. I mean, that's one time when I think about practicing the Buddhist teachings. All he's saying is learn to not be reactive. Learn not to get caught in these mental whirlings that we react to things that arise that we don't like, or things that we really like and we want to hold on to, for that matter. Equally, sources of suffering. Don't want to finish, of course, with a bit of poetry. This is from Mary Oliver's book of poems called Thirst, and it's actually series of poems she wrote soon after her partner of many years had passed away. And so she's dealing with it, with the suffering of having lost her dearest person in her life. And so a lot of the poetry she wrote around that time is around these themes. And this one, this says what I want to say in 20 lines, perhaps. It's called Heavy. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, "It's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down." So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. This is, she understood the first noble truth. She understood. And she expresses it so beautifully in her poetry. So that's what I have to say tonight about the first noble truth, that we have to start understanding. This is what right understanding is really all about, in a sense. This is the right understanding we have to come to eventually, is that we have to learn not to be overwhelmed by the truth of life that is there right in our face all the time, if we let ourselves see it. And be able to be okay with the fact that, sure enough, as the Buddha discovered as he rode out there looking at the world, that everybody's going to get sick, everybody's going to get old, and everybody's going to die, including us. And we have to be able to take that in and go, and that's okay. I don't like it. I'm not saying you have to like it. Be happy about it. No, you don't have to be happy about it either. But you have to be like, yeah, this is true. Like, really take it in and realize it's true without exception. No one gets a pass. A friend used to say, Life is a disease with 100% mortality rate. She describes it pretty well.